Like, I'm one of those people that maybe doesn't know my true financial goals. So to help a client like me, what could they do?
No, agree. I mean, I have a personal story too, where I was talking to an advisor and they asked me that question, and it was after I had done the research, and I still didn't quite know how to approach it. So it was
good on
you need tools. Yeah.
Hello, Framework listeners. I'm your host, Ana Trujillo-Limon, and today I'm super excited to be joined by Samantha Lamas, Senior Behavioral Researcher at Morningstar. Sam, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for making time for me.
Oh, of course. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so we always like to kick off the show with a fun question, and it's usually because we love to gather, well, we do our own kind of research here at Framework, but one of my favorite things is to gather people's money memories. So what was your first money memory?
Ooh, I would love to hear a follow-up of how that research is going, because I think this is such a fun question. Okay, so I had to really think about this one. My first money memory had to be a weekly allowance that, you know, my parents gave all us kids when we were small. And it wasn't anything big. I want to say it was like $5 or something, because it was four of us. And I did have to ask my mom what I spent it on. It turns out I spent it on books.
Of course I did.
So yeah, love of reading from a very young age, I guess.
Oh yeah. I don't know. You might, do you remember like those bookstores like Walden Books? And I think Borders had a bookstore
Borders.
Too.
Oh my gosh.
That was the best to go in there. You had a little bit of cash and you got to pick the book you wanted. Do you remember what book it was or no?
Well, I know when I was younger, I was obsessed with series. Mm-hmm. So like the Junie B. Jones series, that was that age range. And then, you know, the Unfortunate series of events series. Yeah. And then, of course, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings. I loved anything with series, I guess. I don't know. And fiction, of course. If only I was actually learning, but no, it was fiction.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I love the fiction, too. I was into the Nancy Drew when I was little. And ooh, then yes. Goosebumps. And they have a new Goosebumps series on, I think it's Hulu.
Really?
But that took me back to the childhood. Yeah, it's a, gosh, what was it? I can't remember the actor's name, but he's so funny and he's in it. And it's just great. I don't know. If you love the Goosebumps, you will love this series on Hulu.
Okay. Okay. Jack Black. I think I've seen previews.
Oh, I'm not sure. I can't remember his name. Okay. I can't confirm or deny, you know.
Okay. No, I believe you. Worth a watch.
Yeah, I love books. And now I'm diving into, I got back from the CFP Board Diversity Summit and Farnoosh Tarabi was there and she was signing copies of her new book, which is, I think, A Healthy State of Panic is what it's called. And it's so good. Oh. I'm just flying through it. But anyways, for everybody listening, that's a great,
write
great
that book. Down.
Yes, healthy state of panic. But yeah, awesome. So another great research tidbit we like to do here is find out your origin story into the profession. So tell us a little bit. I know you studied finance at Dominican University. Tell me, what did you want to be when you were little growing up and how did you come to be a behavioral researcher?
Yeah. So when I was little, I think because of reading so much, I always wanted to be a writer, like an author. It turns out you have to come up with your own stories and it's a lot of work. So I haven't gone that route. Maybe one day. Because of course, you know, my love for fiction would have to be fictional stories, even though nonfiction would be great. But so that didn't really factor into my career decisions thus far. I know when I first started at Dominican University, I right away knew it was going to be finance, and I had a couple of reasons. One, I wanted a job. So anything with English, I'm like, I have no idea what I would do with that. Finance, you know you're going to get a job. And two, I did think it was a very important subject. You know, growing up, we were middle class, maybe lower middle class. And, you know, you're surrounded by so many people who are struggling with money decisions. Mm-hmm. And in my naive mind, I thought they just didn't know the right things to do. So of course, if I studied finance, I would know the right things to do and I would be able to help people make those right decisions. So that's what I pursued. And then when I came into Morningstar, I was really driven by, you know, the Morningstar mission about helping investors, empowering investors, investor success, et cetera. And it is very much that. That's why I'm still here today. But one thing I realized is that even when people know the right thing to do, they don't do the right thing. And then that there's this behavior gap that you can know all the right answers, but it's still hard to make those right decisions in the moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of drew me to behavioral science. I found the behavioral insights team here at Morningstar, and I've kind of been here ever since, just sort of building up my skill set, trying to understand humans. And it's funny because I feel like the more I get into the topic or into the subject, the less I understand. So I mean, that's probably how it goes. But yeah, I've been here ever since, and it's just I'm so driven by trying to help people make better decisions with their money, which is really hard to do.
Yeah, for sure. So to that end, you know, so you are really a writer. You do write a lot of stuff for Morningstar. You do write a lot of research. So you kind of make that dream come
There's
true.
There's something there. Yeah.
So speaking of that research, let's dive into that, the meat of that. So this month we're tackling behavioral finance here on Framework. And I know that you have done an amazing amount of research in this area. And so you had a really interesting research study that just came out around uncovering seven behaviors that could negatively impact the relationship with the advisor and kind of lead to some disengagement there. Tell us a little bit about that research and give us kind of an overview and what takeaways people should take from that.
Yeah. So that research, we call it the advisor faux pas research, which I'm very proud of the name of, but some people don't like it. But anyways, thank you. The idea there is that there's this concept of like death by a thousand cuts, right? What are the tiny mistakes that are prompting investors to disengage? And it's kind of part of a series that we've been working on. So we did why investors hire advisors, why they fire their advisors, and we're doing continue next. But this was our in between. Because when you look at why people fire their advisor, the truth is not a lot of people fire their advisor. There's never those direct conversations. Instead, they kind of just disengage. So, you know, stop reaching out. Maybe they take out a bit of assets. And I think that's bad for both sides, right? The investor's not getting the advice they need. And the advisor is holding on to these resources for this client, and this client's not really giving it back, right? So that's why we wanted to dig into that. So what's causing this disengagement versus outright firing? Okay. So we did look at a lot of different potential things that advisors do that could annoy their clients. Turns out some of them weren't that annoying. Some people actually liked, which I think were really interesting. And we're hoping to do a follow-up piece on as well. But when it came to what behaviors investors disliked and had a negative impact on the relationship, there was those seven. So one, that my advisor did not adequately explain fees. They took more than a week to complete tasks. They used jargon. They did not consider my values. They didn't provide enough details when covering investment options. They made me fill out long, complex forms, and they didn't provide holistic advice. And we actually found that these things had a negative impact on the advisor-client relationship directly. So things like on a client's willingness to trust the advisor, to delegate decisions to the advisor, to collaborate with them more, to give them assets, to recommend them to family and friends. So doing these tiny little mistakes that may not seem too detrimental in the short term, right, can actually have a negative impact on the client-advisor relationship.
Part of being a great fiduciary is helping your clients understand their full financial picture, and it should be no different for your life. Do you know what your business is worth? Get your firm valuation today with our free valuation calculator. Whether you're looking to share equity with your team, buy another firm, prepare for an exit, or just simply want to see the market value of your business, visit carsongroup.com/valuation to get started.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And then you came up with a two-step process that could help advisors kind of recognize and address when some of these things might be happening or their clients might be disengaging. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah. And the two-step process, it's extremely simple. And I think that's part of the genius of it, right? We made it up. So of course I'm biased. But step one is just having this checklist. And the checklist covers the top five things that investors disliked when working with clients. And it's our instructions are to review the checklist maybe before you meet with a client. And then maybe at the 10-minute mark of when the meeting's going to end, just, you know, kind of skim over it again. And the point is that you want to try to avoid these mistakes, but we know that a lot of our behaviors are ingrained, our habits are ingrained. So you need that reminder to pause and reconsider. And you need that 10-minute mark to make sure that if you did fall into those old habits, can I make up for it now? You know, are there any pieces of jargon that I use that I could try to explain to the client? Did I fully explain their financial plan? Because in our study, we actually found that frequency does, I mean, it kind of works against advisors in a sense that if you do this mistake once, it's going to have a negative impact. If you do it 20 times, it's going to have a negative impact, which kind of means that, you know, strike one and you're out kind of thing. So you want to make sure that if you are making these mistakes, you're addressing them right away. Because we know it can negatively impact the relationship. So that's step one, just having this checklist out and reviewing it before the meeting and maybe during. And step two is a follow-up survey. So this is our first time trying to create a survey for advisors or the audience to download on their own. So if you guys, if anyone tries it and has any trouble, let us know. But the idea of the survey is that you're giving your client some time to, you know, consider, is there any pieces of information that I didn't understand? Do I fully understand the plan and the time in which I should be hearing back from the advisor? And it's all done online. So maybe the advisor sends it to them the day after they met. So that gives them one, they can be completely honest, right? You're not sitting in front of the advisor. You don't have to be nice. And two, it's giving them some time to kind of think about the meeting, think about what went well, what didn't, et cetera. And then hopefully an advisor can take those survey results and figure out, okay, yeah, there's a few things I have to follow up with them on. And this is a, you know, this is a, has multiple benefits. One, you're getting that feedback from the client of whether or not your conversation went well. And two, if you're falling prey to any of these old habits. But two, this is also another chance to re-engage with your client. Mm-hmm. So if things didn't go well, say, hey, you know, let's schedule a Zoom meeting. Let's talk on the phone really quick to address any of your concerns. Because one thing we actually did find with the research too is that frequency of engaging with your client can help mitigate the negative impact of these behaviors. So say on your first meeting with them, you forgot to really go into fees because fees was one of the top things that we saw. But since then you've met with them 20 times. Maybe they'll forget that mistake you made along the, a year ago, right? As you would hope. But just engaging with clients, talking to them. And that could be a Zoom meeting. This could be an in-person meeting. This could be an email. This could be a newsletter. It could be social media, just keeping yourself top of mind and making sure they know that you're available, that you're there, that you're engaged, et cetera.
So was there like an ideal kind of sweet spot for the number of engagements that led to kind of that positive experience?
You know what? We didn't look for a specific number, but one thing I would say is that it's that frequency of engagement or interactions that matter. So this is not the first study that we found this interesting relationship with interactions. In our past research, we looked at what prompts an investor to trust their advisor. And one of the things that pops out there was frequency of interactions. This wasn't just meeting. I mean, this was just talking to the client, a text. I don't know how advisors talk to their clients nowadays. Even just social media, just keeping them top of mind and making sure that they know that you exist. Which just sounds kind of silly, right? Because, you know, everyone kind of just bats their eyes at social media, at least some people in the finance world. But if your client is on social media and they're thinking about a certain financial problem and the first person they see on their feed is a influencer that maybe doesn't have the best credentials, I mean, that's a bad thing, right? They're going to be thinking of them as advice versus you.
That makes sense. Yeah, we have a bunch of some advisors in our ecosystem who do an excellent job with the social media stuff. Mm-hmm. Like people come to mind right away. Larry Sprung, I don't know if you follow him, Midland Financial. He does really amazing staying that top of mind, sharing pieces of his life and who he is and his advice. And Elena Macy, she also does a Bloom. She does a great job of it too. So yeah, I can see that. Like people, because you follow these folks and they are top of mind across sectors, not just in our industry. So yeah, that's great advice. But going back, you said this was one of a part of several studies that kind of build on top of each other. And I'm curious about the firing perspective. And I know we didn't have that on our list, but if you have some time, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
And can you give us like an overview of some of the most interesting findings from that research and tell us about that?
Yeah, no, the fire one is a fun one. And I had the results ready because I figured it would come up. So no worries about that. So for the fire research, we just, it was pretty simple research design. So it's all open text. We pretty much asked people who had fired an advisor before just to list out reasons why they fired their advisor. So we had a bunch of open text. We did some really fun manual coding, some natural language processing on the content itself. But what we found is that the top five categories of reasons of why people fire their advisor were quality of financial advice and services, quality of relationship, cost of services, comfort handling financial issues, quality of communication, and return performance driven factors. So they all sound a little bit finance related on the surface, but when you actually dig into the responses, you realize that a lot of these issues could have been remedied by focusing on this more emotional relationship angle of the relationship. So for example, quality of financial advice and services, a lot of the people in this category listed out certain gaps in the services that the advisor was providing. But a lot of that could have been remedied if the advisor just sat down and took the time to understand what services the client needs. So we know that when an investor comes into an advisor-client conversation, they're going to go based off of top-of-mind issues, top-of-mind goals, right? And it's up to the advisor to really help the client dig deeper, understand their own needs and goals and values, what services can be applied here, what services can't. And it seems like a lot of advisors weren't doing that additional step. And that's what one of the things that ruined that relationship. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense because it's like they were just scratching the surface versus diving deep into the relationship. So it's really relationship based is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, agreed. And that's kind of, I mean, even when we look at cost of services, right, that one seems obvious, right? Oh, this was too expensive. But when you look at the responses, it was really people saying that I don't know what this advisor is providing me to warrant this cost.
Yeah.
So it was just the advisor not doing a good job at effectively communicating their value, right? All the services they're providing besides investment advice, which, you know, we all know investors still associate advisors with, even though advisors do so much more than that. So again, it was about that communication angle. It was about trying to understand who the person is as an individual, what their personalized needs are. And that takes some digging. It takes for their advisor to kind of be that financial therapist or whatever. We always call it behavioral coach, but whatever term you want to use here about helping the client dig deeper. Yeah.
No, that's excellent. And so like for those advisors who maybe are just scratching the surface and not developing those relationships and communicating, what are some good resources for people to develop that behavioral coach element of their, you know, advisory relationship?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first step is to try to, you know, catch up on behavioral finance research, like, right? Just understand that when you're talking to a person, you're dealing with a human, and that comes with a bunch of biases, you know, histories, financial narratives, et cetera, just the role that psychology can play in financial decisions. But then step two is we really recommend to lean on ready-made resources, tools, checklists. That's why a lot of our papers has checklists because we're human too, right? Even if we have these ideas in our mind, when we're going into a conversation with a client, we could forget that, you know, that we should make sure we cover our fees directly, you know, or make sure we're not using any jargon, even though we're living and breathing this content. The client isn't living and breathing this content. Yeah, that's one of the pieces of advice we have in our research paper to lean on tools. We actually mention our goal setting checklist that we wrote about a while back. But in that checklist, it helps the investor slow down, carefully consider their goals. It takes them through an iterative process of goal setting. So it's not just one direct question. And we find that this quick checklist kind of helps people dig deeper, have those more intense conversations. And advisors can lean on that tool to guide them to more intense conversations. And there's plenty of other resources. I mean, we've made a couple. A lot of other people have made a couple. I feel like behavioral finance is becoming more of a space. Mm-hmm. But now that advisors are being sort of thrust into this role of a behavior coach, a financial therapist, et cetera, if you can't go back and get intensive training on these conversations, maybe lean on tools of people who have studied this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And that's perfect, because that's what we are going to talk about next, right? This shift into kind of goals-based planning. And I know you've put on LinkedIn before that people are kind of skeptical about this because they think clients might not know their true goals. So what are some ways that advisors can help clients uncover those true financial goals? Because I mean, as a consumer and a client, it's like sometimes, yeah. You know, my first meeting with an advisor, even though I've written about stuff and, you know, all that, I was kind of like, I don't even know. Like, I'm one of those people that maybe doesn't know my true financial goals. So to help a client like me, what could they do?
No, agree. I have a personal story too, where I was talking to an advisor and they asked me that question, and it was after I had done the research and I still didn't quite know how to approach it. So it was,
good on
you need tools. Yeah. So I kind of mentioned, I kind of previewed the research that we did there. We pretty much tested out a 3-step process to help people find their true financial goals. Step 1 is pretty simple. Write down your top 3 financial goals. Step 2 is we take them through a master list. And there's nothing special about this list. It's just goals that we kind of source from existing academic articles, industry articles, et cetera. We think it's comprehensive, but we've seen advisors customize this list according to their services. And we ask the client to carefully consider each option here and cross out the ones that aren't important to them, or check off the ones that are important to them they just forgot to mention in that step 1. And it kind of helps them split up the generative from the evaluative process, right? Usually when you're asked this question, you have to come up with goals that sound good and then figure out if they're right for you. Here, we're giving you the goals to work off of. So you can spend more time on that evaluative phase of understanding if these goals are right for you. And then in step 3, we ask them to consider what they wrote in step 1, step 2, all the things that they checked off, and again, write down their top 3 financial goals, this time in pen. So it's more permanent. And what we find is that 70% of people actually change one of their top 3 goals after going through this process. And this is a problem because people are creating their financial plans off of these top of mind goals that actually don't represent what's important to them. So that's kind of terrifying, right? Because we know having the right goals is important. It's motivating. It's satisfying for the client. It helps make them happier, right? Mm-hmm. And people are working off of the wrong goals. So that's one of the things that we kind of suggest to going through this goal setting process. Recently, we've done kind of step 2 of this research, and I'm kind of excited about it, which we call, and we're not very creative, it's called digging deeper for goals. So don't judge us there. But in this project, we're trying to help people connect their financial goals. So after they've gone through this process, they know their financial goals, trying to connect those financial goals to their life values, life goals, these deeper motivations for what makes them happy as humans. Mm-hmm. And it came out of a survey that was done by the Rational Reminder podcast. I don't know if you've listened to their work. Mm-hmm. They're great. Definitely recommend.
Okay.
But they helped us do a survey where they tested this 3-step process. So again, the 3 steps. Step 1 is to write down your financial goals, and they kind of help guide people a little bit through that. Step 2 is to try to double your goals. Mm-hmm. And then step 3 is that they kind of provided this PERMA-V framework. So PERMA-V framework is it comes from the world of positive psychology, but it's basically the factors that constitute to well-being. So positive emotions. Oh, I think I've opened it up on my screen somewhere. Positive emotions, time with loved ones, vitality, etc. Mm-hmm. And then they asked them to write down their financial goals based off of this. And what we found when we were digging through the data is that people actually, by that third step, they were actually getting to goals that sounded a lot more like life values, like life goals. Like, I want to be able to spend time with my loved ones. I want to spend time doing my hobbies. I want to make sure I allocate resources to living a healthy lifestyle, et cetera. So what's important to helping them be happy as human beings?
Yeah.
And the idea here is that if a advisor helps a client through this process, helps them find their financial goals, then their life values, then they're able to connect those financial goals back to life values, or life values to financial goals. And this can help with the flexibility problem, right? Say a client comes in, they have all these financial goals. They don't really know where they're going. Where's the end point? But these life values kind of provide this constant North Star. You know exactly where you're going. No matter what happens in your life, this is what makes you happy. And now it's about making sure these financial goals are good strategies to meet that higher end. So we give the example, like say a client walks in and they have this goal of retiring early, but that's all it is. They just want to retire early. Then you come into a financial advisor and then they help you work towards your life values. And apparently what this person actually wants to do is spend more time, you know, volunteering or spend more time on their hobbies. In which case, maybe you don't want to retire early. Maybe you want to go down to part-time and have all this extra time to spend on those hobbies, on volunteering, et cetera. So that's something that the advisor couldn't get to if they didn't try to reach for these life goals instead. So again, we're trying to give more of a structure around life goals, life values, financial goal planning, and mitigate some of those issues that people often find with goals-based investing.
Yeah. So I'm curious about, you had said that people oftentimes change this. So in adding this PERMA-V model, does it kind of, does it like mitigate that risk of people changing their top financial goals? Have you found that or not yet?
Well, part of the... that would require more research, but I think the power of the life goals is that life goals seem to be kind of consistent. So the advisor knows exactly what the client is going to. Maybe their initial financial goals was a beach house in Santa Barbara, but life got in the way. The budget didn't work out. Now they're still trying to reach that life goal of spending time with loved ones, having that center node, which they thought this beach house would be. But now this financial goal can be flexible, right? Maybe it's not a beach house. Maybe it's a lake house in the Midwest, but you're still reaching that life goal of spending time with loved ones, for example. So it kind of helps, it inserts some flexibility into the plan.
I see. So it gives them kind of more of the bigger picture to where like the puck is going. I don't know if sports analogy is that great, but that seems like an appropriate one. Okay, awesome. That's great. So we have here at Carson, the blueprinting guide that Ron Carson developed, which helps kind of, it's for advisors. It was initially for advisors to kind of establish their goals and their vision and kind of craft their firm based on all of that. But we do have like a client version that kind of speaks to what you're talking about, like identifying your life goals first, you know, to kind of build that. So I love that concept. It all ties together. It's beautiful. So we've talked about, go ahead, Samantha.
Sorry. No. I'm just so excited about the topic, about life goals in general, just because I think it can, we haven't tested this out, but I feel like it can kind of also relate to everyday spending. Mm-hmm. You know, in this world of constant distractions and social comparisons and Instagram and social media, like, can we help people direct their everyday spending to their life goals as well? Like, why do we have to wait till retirement to talk about life goals? I don't know, but the future ideas, but I agree. Like, I'm glad that other people are working in this space.
Yeah, I love it. So we've talked about a lot of research today. And so you've done a lot of research of all of it. What would you say is some of your favorite research that you've done and why?
Yeah, well, I think just based on my excitement, it's clear that I think this life goal research is some of my favorite research. I think it's so applicable to everyday people, all investors, no matter where you are in your journey, just trying to make sure that your spending, your your saving habits, everything that you do is aligned with what's actually important to you as a person. Mm-hmm. And in today's day and age where it's so easy to get overwhelmed by all this stimuli, all these products being thrown in your face, just trying to simplify your money decisions. We know if anything, we know from behavior research, the more simple that money decision, it's better, the better it is, the more aligned we can make our decisions with our goals. So if these life values can help make these decisions simpler for people, I think that can be very powerful.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So what's one takeaway from this interview that you want our listeners to kind of take and implement in their firms and practices today?
I'll give you a high level one and then maybe a more practical one. I think on the high level, it's just important to remember that at the root of every money decision is a person, and this person is biased. They have these knowledge gaps. They're distracted. They're busy. They're overworked, etc. You know, we all have so much on our plates, and sometimes financial decisions aren't at the core of our being. So when you're trying to help them make a decision, try to make it easy for them, and don't forget that you're dealing with a human. And one way to do that is to lean on processes, tools, checklists, etc. Doesn't have to be ours, could be anyone else's, but just helping a person break down the decision so that when they're asked, you know, what are your overarching 30-year financial goals, it's not so overwhelming and difficult.
Love it. And you said you had another takeaway that you wanted to?
Well, I kind of coupled it into one.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Perfect. So, it works for me. I love efficient and simple, just like you said, right?
Efficient and simple. Exactly.
So, Sam, this has been so much fun. And people listen to these and often want to find and connect with you. Where's the best place for them to do that?
Yeah, I think probably the best place would be LinkedIn. I think I'm more active there. I'm also on Twitter, just not as active. And then also, as you mentioned, I do write a lot for Morningstar.com. So our articles are always up there too.
Ah, perfect. So we always end our episodes with the same question that ties back into kind of what we do here at Carson. And so that question is, what does finding your freedom mean to you?
Yeah, this was a hard one. I think freedom to me, it means freedom of choice. So having the flexibility to make a decision, you know, to take a job offer or not, or to, even when you go to the grocery store, to buy organic or not. I guess I relate it back to financial freedom, but still, that's kind of what freedom means to me.
No, I love that. That's a beautiful answer. Well, Sam, I so enjoyed our time together. Thank you for joining us. And thank you, everybody else, for tuning into this episode of the Framework Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.